Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. For those of you keeping score at home, I am Aaron Foster, and I'm your new host. I was introduced a few weeks back, and I'm really excited to be with you on our first show. Just a little background on me. I own Foster Sundry, which is a artisan cheese counter, whole animal butcher, and specialty grocer and cafe in Bushwick, Brooklyn, just less than a half mile down the road from our recording studio here. And my guest today is going to be Glenn Hills. Glenn is sort of cheese royalty. He's got it in his blood. And I'm really excited. He's just a wealth of knowledge and has been doing this, I think, more or less his whole life.
Thank you, Aaron. And congratulations on your hostorial debut.
Oh, yes.
Is that what it's called?
Hostatorial?
Hostatorial.
I think so.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself real quick before we dive into our show?
Okay, so I grew up in cheese in a way, via a family business.
Just all in the crib that was just filled with cheese.
Yeah, it's hard to put my finger on the retail experience or like the years because I started sampling when I was like 4 or 5 and that was really my gig until I was like in sixth grade. And then I started interacting with customers more, and cutting cheese and stuff.
That's when they really cut it at that point.
That's when I was cutting the curd.
Cool. Yeah. And then, I guess probably the most relevant experience to, this show is going to be your most recent.
Yeah, to this show, definitely. I worked at an importer of cheese from Europe, mostly the Alps, Switzerland. It was Columbia Cheese. Awesome, awesome list and people. And yeah, that was a super dreamy job.
Yeah, we might as well now erase the secret of what this show is going to be about, which is... I think we kicked around a few names for it. Cow to counter, fromage to your face. Essentially, we're going to be talking about supply chain. And I can hear eyes. I don't know if eyes make a sound when they glaze over, but I think I can hear it right now when someone says, we're going to talk about the supply chain for half an hour. But I think the reason we chose this show as a topic is because it's actually super interesting. And I think a lot of folks, even a lot of cheese people, don't really understand or really have a full grasp of how complex, how efficient, and how important the supply chain is to get cheese from the farm. I think in this show we're going to talk mostly about, say, rural farms in Western Europe, mm-hmm. to a random cheese counter in Brooklyn or in California, or even in Japan or farther flung locales.
Yeah, we each know what we know. And I always found learning more about the supply chain as a retailer was an empowering thing. It just helped kind of paint the path, so to speak. And it made the product feel less like a commodity, despite already thinking that the product was like super romantic.
Right. And it's also interesting, I think, because when we talk about supply, I think when people hear the word supply chain, they really just think like widgets being made in China and shipped to in big boxes across the ocean on big freighters into American factories or whatever. And I think that it's interesting because there are certain parts of that are analogous to what happens with cheese. But then because cheese, particularly, I think we're going to be mostly speaking about artisan cheese, mm-hmm. Is such a living, breathing thing. It's actually a lot more complicated than that. And pretty remarkable that it works at all, to be honest. I think that's the real surprise. So when we, I guess when we talk about, just to define our terms here, like when we're talking about supply chain, what, you know, what does that entail for you?
Well, so I know in this episode, we're talking about it in terms of milk to table or milk
sure.
to mouth.
Milk to mouth. Great. I love it.
I mean, typically I consider the supply chain happening from, you know, post-production. Like that's what we're talking about. Once the product is ready, then everything from there to the mouth. And it is, I mean, think of a chain or think of a Rube Goldberg machine.
Right. It sort of is like that, like mousetrap.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not necessarily like the whole system waiting for that one ball to arrive, right? The lever might not snap until 3,000 balls are in that little cup.
Right. Exactly. And there's many more just behind it and just behind that.
Yes.
Totally. And I think, you know, when we talk about, there's just so many other shows that we've done at Cutting the Curd that have really gotten into like the nitty gritty of cheese making. So I think we really just, we don't need to focus as much on that here today. Yeah, you can listen, scroll through the archives for that kind of detail. So, I mean, why don't we start talking about Gruyere and just as a, just throwing out a cheese that comes from Western Europe that I think has a fairly interesting supply chain.
Cool.
And I know it's one that you're quite familiar with. Let's, you know, where does Gruyere like begin its journey to, like, I sell Gruyere on my counter.
Yeah.
You know, we sell it right down the street. There's probably some on the menu here at Roberta's. So, you know, how does it start its journey to my counter?
Yeah. So, you know, we're starting at milk. We could even go back to inputs and talk about the land and feed.
Oh, man, I didn't even.
I think that's another podcast series,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, maybe we should make that like the 201 of this podcast.
Yeah. And I like that. And so starting at the milk in Europe, and, you know, I'm mostly thinking of village dairies in the Alps right now. But, you know, milk, really, regardless, can come directly from the farmer. There are operations so small where milk is bought and farmers just carry milk cans over on carts, right? They're
like
also
the, like your next, like Ned Flanders is like bringing, he's got the cows and Homer's making the cheese and he just like, here you go. Heidly ho.
Maybe closer. Like you're standing at the dairy and you can like hear a barnyard door open and it's that like on the property, it's still a neighbor.
And so if we're defining terms, like this would be the difference between like farmstead cheese and then I guess not farmstead cheese.
This would be, yeah, I mean, in that like farmstead artisan industrial
breakdown
three-way paradigm, yeah. This would be artisan because they're not raising the animals. But you know, village dairy, I think it's more specific because it's talking about obviously the village and yeah, just speaking to that small economy.
Right. So we're sitting here, we've got a dairy, which is just going to be like a cheese making. All that guy does is make the cheese.
Yeah. So it increases specialization that way. That's right. What I love about it is the farmers just get to focus on their cows.
Well, I feel like in America,
and cheese makers just make cheese. And that's enough. If anything, that's like their ideal.
Because one person can get super good at what they do.
Yeah,
and
as
then
opposed
not
to trying
distracted.
To tackle it all. Yeah.
So like a different example would be like, I think a lot of people, when they think of American cheesemakers, you're thinking of like the farmer who also, he's got the animals, maybe, or she, oftentimes in America, grows the feed, raises the animals, milks them, and then makes the cheese on the farm, and then ages it and packages and sells it all in one place.
So many things.
It's so hard. And Europe has like long since kind of, for the most part, moved away from that model.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Fermier thing is super romantic and that is its own thing. That's and those cheeses are distinguishable and unique. But
all right. So let's just because we're.
We got to. Well, yeah,
no,
we
got to
keep moving.
So cheese. So we're at the basically the cheese. The first step would be, say, the milk going from the folks that milk the animals,
yeah,
gets taken to the dairy, which is usually quite close,
yeah,
and then the cheese gets made in the dairy.
Correct.
So
and from there the cheese could be aged
right
on site, right, or it could go to some kind of regional aging facility, either I mean, if it's an AOP cheese, it's going to be owned by an affineur that's like in the AOP.
Right. AOP being like the Swiss consortium or French consortium.
Yeah. 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 Or a PDO or whatever.
AOC,
yeah,
PDO.
Whatever country you're in.
Yeah. GTFO. Yeah. It's one of those is not real, but.
And that is typically overseen by that transportation, since we're talking about supply chains, is typically overseen either by the producer or the person aging the cheese. From what I've seen, there's not usually a third party at that step.
Right. So like either the producer puts it in his van, drives it over, or the affineur, the maturer, the cheese ager, you know, sends over her truck, picks it up, and then brings it back to the place where they're aging the cheese.
Yeah.
And I feel like size is important to think of here, because like if we're talking about Gruyere, these wheels when they're first made are like big floppy tires, greenish yellow tires that weigh 100 pounds or more.
Yeah. They're actually required to stay at the site of production, so at the dairy, for 3 months before they move to the affineur.
And so most dairies probably only have enough space for about 3 months worth of cheese, because it doesn't make sense for them to have more.
Yeah. That's right. So
then the cheese goes to driver comes, picks it up, and is taking it over to this affineur, this cheese ager. And this is where it's going to spend like, of all the time in the supply chain, as if we're talking about a hard cheese, this is where it's going to like spend the most time at this apartment, right?
Yeah, with Gruyere, it's either going to spend like 3 months to make it a total of 6 months, or it will keep going and get up to 2 years, you know, usually not more than that.
And like those places can be crazy because they're holding, like aren't small versions of this, right?
100,000 wheels.
That's so many wheels.
Yeah, it's leveraging... this cheese is like it's a business. It's a bank.
Right. And I know in Italy they still accept like wheels of cheese as collateral for loans and things like that.
It works.
That's just because you know it's just sitting hanging out in a bank. You might as well put gold away. And for the cost of some of these cheeses, you probably could do better with cheese. So it's hanging out here. And again, it's not really doing much. So let's just move, I think, to the next part of the supply chain, because this is kind of where it starts to get more interesting.
Yeah.
After it, let's say it's like the French affineur has gone around and she's tasted all of her cheeses and she's like, all right, this one is ready. Well, let's talk. Well, so I think it's important to note that she's not, if we're assuming this cheese is coming to America, right? She's not saying it's ready to eat now. She's got to already be thinking about the supply chain and where this cheese is going.
Yeah.
So if the cheese is going to a local shop in Switzerland, like you want a cheese that's ready to eat right then. But if it's going to spend another 3 months, 2 months in the supply chain, you don't want the cheese to be over the hill by the time it gets to customers.
That's it. You're a bit of a fortune teller. You're looking into the future and making sure it's on target to hit a profile 2 months from that point.
Right. And you would say, and you have to really know where each wheel is headed. And I think that's like one of the great skills of these agers.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We're also like, we're standing on the shoulders of giants in terms of packaging, in terms of just like,
right.
This stuff is already figured out in a lot of ways.
And particularly in Switzerland, where it's so sophisticated, they're using lasers and ultrasound and water picks to slice cheese to exact weights.
The models are there. Like we have the luxury of just kind of focusing on our palates and thinking about the future. Now we don't have to reinvent the wheel and think like, okay, like is this type of cardboard going to kill the rind of this cheese?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's super interesting. And I think it's certainly something that I've seen American cheesemakers struggle with, because they don't have this history of making the same cheese year after year after year and having the opportunity to have tried all of these different and sort of iterate and evolve the right packaging. They're just like, oh, I made a new cheese. I'm calling it Bazinga, and it is a washed rind, and I don't know what to put it in what shape it's going to be in, or whether it'll bump around and hit the sides and lose its texture or whatever.
That's right.
So I think certainly at this point, let's say we've decided the cheese is coming to me. This is a wheel of Gruyere that's like earmarked for Foster Sundry.
Cool.
Which we have done in the past, but we don't do for Gruyere specifically, but we have certainly done for other cheeses.
Well,
you know what? Let's take a break real quick. It's time for a 15 or it's time for just a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with more from Glenn, and we'll continue to nerd out. Thank you.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of the Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach Cave Age cheeses, Der Scharfer Max, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. Again, I'm Aaron Foster. This is my inaugural show. Very happy to have you here. We are discussing the supply chain, and don't change the channel. It is super interesting, I promise. And I've got Glenn Hills with me, and we're going to go ahead and pick up where we left off, which was we had just decided that this Wheel of Gruyere is ready to come from a vault blasted out of the side of a mountain in Switzerland to my shop in Brooklyn, and it's in that mountain right now. Where does it go next?
Well, it can go to a variety of places. If it's coming to the U.S., it's probably going to head to Paris or that general vicinity, because that's where that's the spoke in the wheel when it comes to Western Europe.
So, like, if it's basically the sort of midpoint between where most of the cheese is made, is that the general idea, or
that's the general idea.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good center point.
I guess France itself has a lot of cheese too that wants to leave and come to the U.S.
Yeah, for some reason they just decided to
make it there.
Tent there.
Yeah. Okay, so it goes to Paris.
Yeah, so there's this town called Rungy, and it's
Rungy.
Rungy. I think Aaron, you might have to help me with this.
No, I like it. That sounds right.
Rungis.
Okay.
And it's a little bit like Hunt's Point here that we have here in New York City in the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
Functions as
right. And Hunt's Point is a place in New York where it turns out that something like 85% of all imported food, some ridiculous amount, like, will travel through on its journey to somewhere else in the U.S.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And like Hunt's Point, it's predominantly business to business.
Okay. Like, I wouldn't go shopping for, like, my Thanksgiving dinner at Hunt's Point.
Yeah, I don't get that vibe as much. Like, you need a pass to get in. I know there's some, like, consumer-facing stuff there. But the, you know, the majority of the business is business to business. It's importers, exporters, cheesemakers, distributors, brokers who set up shop there.
And it's not just cheese,
the market,
right?
And they sling cheese, and there's a bit of everything there. But cheese does have its own hall or series.
It's huge,
of
right?
Halls. Yeah, it's like airplane hangars, but really, like, clean, pretty,
really
pristine.
Clean airplane hangars.
And then just, like, cheese on every pallet, and it's cheese from, like, every nook of Western Europe. So you'll see. You'll see Caerphilly. You'll walk 10 feet. You'll see some, like, super obscure German thing next to some
Manchego, Brie, Parm.
Yeah.
All of
stuff.
Yeah. But also little tiny artisan stuff as well.
Yeah.
So it's basically like everything stops there on its way out of the country. And, like,
it stops
it's
in
like
that
the TSA.
Town. It doesn't necessarily hang out inside the market.
Gotcha.
Other shops and players in the game have set up in that vicinity. So basically, like, in the same parking lot as the market.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
So they're different, like, consolidators or exporters.
And they're like tailgaters.
Both. Yeah. They're tailgaters. Yeah. They open up this giant door. Yeah. It's just this party of cheese.
So, like, and that, and this is where the port is also, or is near the port?
So the port is in the north, Le Havre.
Le
Havre. H-A-V-R-E.
All right.
And yeah, that's on the, like, English Channel. Like, the ships that eventually come here, like, kind of run the North Sea. So
they start up in
Rotterdam.
Rotterdam, right.
Yeah, Antwerp, in
so they're basically stopping and they're like dropping off and picking up.
Yeah.
Or are they mostly always picking up?
They're mostly always picking up. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what kind of ship are we talking about here?
Yeah, so we're talking about a large vessel that holds like 3,000 containers, maybe more. The average, I was looking at just like statistics, and the average last year is 3,400 containers per vessel. But that's everything.
And like just to put it in perspective,
that's an average per ship, and they're thousands of ships.
Like we're recording in a shipping container right now, so there's each one holds a lot of stuff.
Yeah, like 20 pallets ish.
And a pallet's like 4x4.
They vary.
1 meter by 1 meter.
Like 40 inches by 48 inches. Yeah.
So I mean that's just an insane amount of cheese in one shipping container.
Oh my god! Yeah, 20 of those things. They're stacked high.
Right. I feel like we'll definitely post some supplementary reading on the show page. We'll post a picture of Maersk is one of the large shipping lines. We'll post a picture of one of their ships with all the containers on it. And there's also an amazing podcast called Containers by Alexis Madrigal that is definitely worth listening to.
Yeah, 99% Invisible has an episode called they partnered. Reefer Madness.
Yep. Yeah. They partnered, I think, with Alexis Madrigal on that episode.
Oh, I like that. Okay. Good.
So we basically we go from Rangis to Le Havre.
Yes.
And then it goes on this boat, and so I think it's important to say, like, these boats are insane. I mean, boat is the wrong word. Ship, like vessel.
Yeah.
Frigate. I don't know what the right, but they are so huge. They're traveling cities essentially, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when we go to the Rockaways, in the summer we sit on the beach and we look out in the ocean and we just count these vessels, and they're huge.
And they're also, so I think,
freaks of nature,
and everything goes on there. And a lot of times you'll hear, I think you'll read about stories in the news about sometimes one of these vessels will go through a rough patch of weather or, something will happen and containers will actually fall off the vessel.
That's a thing. I mean, it's pretty easy to Google image search that, so it must be true.
And it's like not, apparently it happens regularly enough. I did read recently about a study where I can't remember exactly when it happened, but it was a container full of toys, including rubber duckies. And they just...
I read about Doritos.
there was one of Harley's at some point recently as well. But the rubber ducky one, they actually used the rubber duckies.
That's insane.
They decided to turn it into a study. And they, whenever somebody found a rubber ducky, you could log it. You go to a website. And it's like, don't go to this website because I don't know what's there. But it's like, I found my rubberducky.com. Don't go to that website
just to explore,
or go with safe search on
patterns of the ocean.
And they would and they use it to do science that they could never have done otherwise, to find out ocean currents and things like that. And they turned up all over the dam, right, exactly. So this ship, this giant ship, and if you've ever seen the second season of The Wire, it's kind of like where they've got all these, they come off, they go into the port, there's these elaborate gantries that lift them up and put them down, and they fit exactly on a truck, on like a little Mack truck.
Yeah.
And so they get driven on and driven off. And then, of course, they have to pass through. So how long does it take to come from Le Havre to like, and everything comes, and where does it go? Sorry, I should
say. So it's like 9 days. It's, in some ways it's a lot, in other ways it's not, because like on the sales side, we need those orders like 3.5 weeks before that happens. You know, or
I see. So like when you're like planning to order, if like when I ordered this Wheel of Greer that we're talking about, I would have had to order it roughly like 4 weeks ago.
Right. Because there are so many.
Right. Because like, it's got points. They've got to find my wheel in the vault. They've got to put it in a truck and send it to Paris from Switzerland.
And then
it's got to go from Paris to Rungis. And then from Rungis, it's got to get loaded into a container with other cheese that might be arriving at different times. And then it's got to go from there to Le Havre.
To Le Havre.
And then gets on the boat.
Yes.
And the boat, hopefully, if the weather is good and doesn't crash into anything or get knocked off, runs on time, takes about 9 days to get to. And it all comes Newark, right?
Newark. Yeah. Yeah.
Like every,
the first stop in the U.S. typically, I think.
It's like pretty much every artisan cheese coming from Europe goes to Newark, right? It doesn't go anywhere else.
Yeah, that's the general rule. I mean, that's why so much business is based here in terms of cheese.
Importing. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but it's interesting that like it wouldn't go to like Norfolk or Boston or Baltimore or.
Yeah. Some of it's just not like who wants to reinvent the wheel when it's already built, right? Like, who wants to be responsible for that? It's a very costly, just logistical road. Yeah.
And complicated.
Yeah.
So when I, you know, my wheel's now in a container in Newark, how do I get it to my shop? Do I just drive to Newark and pick it up?
No. So from there it needs to clear customs, which happens in a U.S. customs holding house or a bonded customs warehouse.
And is that at the port or it's like anywhere?
And that that's typically off site in this case. And, you know, there could be a scenario like, so I worked at Columbia Cheese, and that's owned by a great guy named Adam Moskowitz, who also owns Larkin Cold Storage, which is one of these bonded warehouses. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So in that situation, trucks would deliver containers of cheese to Larkin every week. So this schedule that we're describing is this file schedule that happens every week. Right.
Okay. So every week is like a file.
Yeah.
And then, so I guess, I mean, it makes sense, right?
Because it's just like this carousel that just keeps
the ship is only going to be in port for like a day, right? Like, it's the idea is to like get things on and off as fast as possible.
That's it. Yeah.
So then, but if you just took everything off and waited for everything to pick everything up, the port would be full constantly. So they, people like come and take everything and put it somewhere else that's not at the port where it can wait.
Get it out of there, let it clear customs. You pay the duties once it clears. That's kind of the beauty of having this bonded warehouse. It gives you like cover in a way. But the warehouse has to be tight. It's got to like live up to.
Right. Like they have to get special like permission from the government or something to be like, I can't just open a warehouse and be like, I will take customs bonded stuff.
Yeah. 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 So from there, it's distribution. Distributors, they pick up from this site. Yeah. And a part of that means cross-docking, right? Because this path is already paved.
Cross-docking sounds like something you'd find on UrbanDictionary.com.
Oh, man, I wish I had that innocence.
I don't have it any longer. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I wish I could see that word differently. So the idea there is, like, distributors are already picking up their imported stuff. So if, like, domestic producers can get their product to this place, then the distributors can pick it all up at once.
So, like, it clears customs. It probably clears, like, USDA or FDA or something like that as well.
Yeah.
And that's just to make sure that, like, food safety... you know, everything is like, there's no bioterrorism or anything.
The CBP, the Customs Border Protection Agency, like they're the like feet on the ground enforcing FDA.
Gotcha.
Regulations.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And then it goes, so it clears customs and it clears FDA, and then it goes to like a warehouse where a distributor can pick it up, or it
then
can be
typically the distributors pick it up. Yeah. Or it's a third party.
Or like I could go pick it up, for example, maybe depending on how much I bought.
Sure. Yeah. Just depending on kind of where you fit into the supply chain.
But like I certainly know, I can think of examples where like I might pre-order a cheese from somewhere in Europe and then my distributor happens to be in Boston or Maine or somewhere. So it comes in and it'll go like up to Boston or up to Maine and then back down to New York.
It's the price we pay for such efficient infrastructure. Right.
Well, it's crazy. It's so funny that you say that. Cause like in my head, that sounds like the most inefficient thing imaginable, but it actually,
right.
If I'm getting stuff from other parts of the country that are going through that place in Boston, it actually does make sense.
Yeah. Because, you know, as you think about the supply chain as a retailer, you think like, oh my God, like I'm kind of the small fish. But then you think like, no, the cheese industry is just a fish in this sea of like all these other fishes. Right. So it means like it behooves us to play this game, like to live on
this like shell game.
Yeah. And to play with other industries, right? Like we kind of have to do that to make this work at the prices we're used to paying for freight.
Now, there's so much more I want to talk to you about, and I feel like we're going to have to do a 201 because I felt like we did a really tight sort of top-down view of how this all works, and I think you ended it so eloquently that like I don't want to then start somewhere else and mess it up. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show. I think it's your first time on the show.
It is. I've been on the other side of this glass many, many times over here.
And
I live a block away.
And it's my first solo show. And I'm delighted to have you aboard. And I think gosh, hopefully they're responsibly good, and we'll have lots to talk about.
Sounds great.
Later. So, yeah, that's it for this week's episode of Cutting the Curd on the Supply Chain. I really appreciate you coming out, and hope you have a lovely holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.